Has there ever been a government leader or politician you didn't like? Actually, that's been a trend throughout history, including in the Bible, where there is lots of criticism of government leaders, including God. So 1,000 years before the birth of Jesus, the people of Israel were critical of God and the leadership that he was giving to their nation. So let me tell you what was happening. In those days, there were 12 territories of Israel. Today, we would probably call them states. In those days, they called them tribes. Each one was pretty much independent and autonomous, and there was no national capital. But there were threats, especially from the neighbor nation of Philistia and the neighbor people of the Amalekites. The Philistines were a smaller country, but with a stronger army, and they often oppressed the Israelites. The Amalekites, by contrast, they were nomadic. They were kind of ancient terrorists who would go into Israelite villages and raid them and rape them and pillage them and destroy the people of the nation of Israel. The government was a theocracy. That is, that God was in charge of the government, although God used individuals as his emissaries to communicate his message. At that time, it was a famous prophet named Samuel, after whom two of the books of the Old Testament are named. And the people of Israel wanted a change. What they wanted was a king, like everybody else. In 1 Samuel 8, when Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah. And they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have," which seemed like a pretty good idea. Samuel was nearing the end of his life. His sons were corrupt and unjust, and the nation was under threat. They needed a strong central leader who could gather an army and defend them. And besides, they wanted to be like the other nations, and having a king seemed to be working out for everybody else. Except Samuel didn't like the idea, and God didn't like the idea. In fact, they both took it personally. But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do." And then there's a list. If you get a king, this is what you can expect. It's kind of like, you know, you go into the hospital for surgery and they make you sign a piece of paper of everything that can possibly go wrong. Well, that's what Samuel gave. If you get a king, he will conscript your sons into an army and many of them will die. He will conscript your daughters into his service and they will be devoted to his projects rather than yours. He will impose upon you a tax of at least 10%. He will confiscate your land, and a day will come when you will plead with God, not for a king, but relief from the king that you have. And so Samuel told the Israelites everything that could go wrong. But the people refused to listen to Samuel. "No," they said, "we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and to fight our battles." When Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered, "Listen to them and give them a king." So what was so wrong with having a king?
It seems on the face of it to me that actually it was a pretty good idea. They needed someone like a king. And besides, God agreed. And God appointed the first king that they got. The problem was that they wanted to put their country ahead of God. They wanted to trust political leaders and government leaders more than God. The problem was they were too patriotic. Now, I was born in the United States of America. I love this country, and I am absolutely loyal to it. But I also know that I have a greater loyalty, that as a Christian, I am a follower of Jesus Christ, and he gets my first allegiance. I know that there are some who are so passionate about their patriotism that they are more passionate about their country than they are about God and godliness. And that was the problem with the people of ancient Israel. It wasn't just that they wanted to promote a king, it's that they were demoting God from his place of leadership in their nation. Now, God still loved them, even though God felt rejected. And so out of his love, he gave into their request and provided for them the best possible choice out of the millions of people in their nation to be their first king. How very good and how very gracious of God that he had offered them choice A and they rejected it. They picked choice B and God was out to bless them even in a less than best choice. We find great encouragement in that because often we take less than the best. That God has for us the job that he wants or the home for us to live in or the person to marry, and we choose otherwise. And then God, in his goodness and graciousness, seeks to bless us and make it as good as can be in the choices that we have made. When Samuel told Saul that he was to be God's first choice as king, it was an amazing day. God still loved Israel and chose for them this 30-year-old farmer from the tribe of Benjamin. It was an unlikely choice. Benjamin was politically insignificant. It didn't have political clout. And Saul, the person that was chosen, was unknown. Nobody had ever heard of him. Isn't like he sought the job. He didn't know anything about it, and in fact, he didn't expect it or want it. But when Samuel told Saul that he was God's choice, Saul answered, "But am I not a Benjamite from the smallest tribe of Israel? And is not my clan the least of the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me?" Even he knew that he was a strange choice. But God was going to be with him. This was God's choice. God would empower this 30-year-old king designate to be a great king. God said that the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you in power, and you will be changed into a different person. Do whatever your hand finds to do, for God is with you. That was in a private announcement. It was later that the public announcement came. You can almost imagine the scene where the leaders of Israel have gathered together and Samuel the prophet is speaking for God. It's as if there is a trumpet fanfare or a drum roll. And then here's Saul. And they couldn't find him. This young king-to-be was humble and shy and was hiding. So they ran and brought him out. And he stood among the people and he was a head taller than any of the others. Samuel the prophet said to all the people, "Do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people." And then the people shouted, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" And on that day in which it was publicly announced that he was to be the first king of Israel, Saul learned a lesson that every leader learns. Every leader. No matter what the position, no matter how old, what time or place. And that is that there are critics. For every leader has those who disagree and oppose. And for Saul, when he went home to Gibeah, he was accompanied by valiant men whose hearts God had touched.
But some troublemakers said, "How can this fellow save us?" They despised him and brought him no gifts. They didn't even know him. They didn't even know who he was. But because he was a leader, they despised him. And Saul, in one of his first actions, showed great wisdom and skill. Because in response to the criticism, he kept silent. And then with God's help, he began to have some very significant successes. One of them related to a town called Jabesh-Gilead. Jabesh-Gilead was east of the Jordan River. It was a walled, I can hardly call it a city. We would say it is a town, but a very small city. And the Ammonites swept down upon this Israelite city and offered them a terrible choice. Now, try to imagine if this is your town. Here's what they were offered. "We can break down your walls and we will kill every one of you, totally annihilate you. Or, choice two, we will gouge out every person's right eye and for the rest of your life you will all be our slaves." Well, it's just an impossible choice to make. So the leaders of Jabesh-Gilead asked for 1 week to decide. And during that time, they sneaked out a message to others in the nation of Israel, asking for them to come to their rescue. The message got to Saul. Saul, in turn, as the new king, sent out a message to the entire nation of Israel, asking them to come into an army to fight against the Ammonites. And 330,000 men showed up. So with Saul at the lead, they swept down on Jabesh-Gilead for a resounding victory and saving their fellow Israelites in that small town. And Saul was a hero. Everybody applauded him. They were thrilled. He was everything they wanted their new king to be. And as for his critics who despised him and said that he could never do the job, there was a word out on the street: kill him. Just kill anybody who's critical of Saul. And Saul, again, with an amazing skill and grace for such a new leader, responded that this is a day of celebration and victory. This is not a day to slaughter those who are our own. And there were other victories and other successes. Saul united the nation. His son Jonathan led in huge victories over the Philistines. The self-esteem of Israel grew over the years that Saul reigned. Sometimes he succeeded against awful odds. For example, just to show how much power the Philistines had in the nation of Israel, they controlled completely the blacksmith industry. So there wasn't one blacksmith in the entire nation of Israel. This is a nation with millions of people, somewhere between 1 and 3 million people. Not one blacksmith in an agricultural society where they needed to sharpen their hoes and their plows. And so what they did was they had to go to Philistine blacksmiths and pay exorbitant fees. But even beyond that, the Philistine blacksmiths refused to ever sharpen a spear or a sword. That meant that the entire nation of Israel was disarmed. So that when Saul led his armies into battle against the Philistines, essentially they didn't have any spears or swords. And yet they were victorious. They were victorious because God gave him an enormous victory. Oh, Saul, he started so spectacularly, so well. But then he began to fail. He who was so humble became arrogant. He made foolish decisions. He had erratic behavior. And he was increasingly disobedient to God. His soldiers, led by his young son, Jonathan, attacked a Philistine outpost one day in a place called Geba. And the Philistines just reacted violently. They didn't want Israel to have a strong army. They didn't want Israel to be anything but under their control. And so they decided they would teach the nation of Israel a military lesson once and for all. So the Philistines gathered 3,000 chariots and 6,000 charioteers. And then they gathered an army of foot soldiers and started to count them, but there were so many of them that they lost count.
So we can figure that maybe there were hundreds of thousands in the army of Philistia. And Saul knew that this was the decisive battle. So he gathered his own army, but this time with far smaller numbers, far less success. He gathered an army with a total of 2,000 men, but 1,400 of those deserted. So he's down to 600 against hundreds of thousands, and the 600 would just shake all day. They just shook because they were so frightened to go into battle, knowing that they were going to have guaranteed defeat and death. But Saul had something that they didn't, and that was a word from God. And the word from God was that Saul and his remaining 600 soldiers were to go to a place called Gilgal and to wait there for the prophet Samuel. And that Samuel would come and he would offer a sacrifice to God on the eve of the battle against the Philistines, and that God would give the victory as a result. So Saul and his men went to Gilgal, and they waited and waited and waited for Samuel to show up. And while they're waiting, day after day, they could see on the horizon the Philistine army, more than anybody could count, surrounding them. And then closing in on them and getting closer and closer. And Samuel wasn't there, and Samuel wasn't there. And Saul made an executive decision that maybe we would have made if we were in the same circumstance. He decided that he would offer the sacrifice to God because he knew that the battle would begin at any moment. And he wanted to grab God's victory. And as soon as he had finished that sacrifice, Samuel showed up. "You acted foolishly," Samuel said. "You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." Do you have a GPS system in your car? I do in my car. And I have kind of a love-hate relationship with this thing. Sometimes it has really helped me. So there have been times when Charlene and I have been looking for a gas station just about out of fuel, and it has told us where there was one that I never otherwise would have found. Or we've been hungry and we found a fast food restaurant, and there have been times when it has given me direction to addresses that I don't think I ever would have found. Those are the good days. But there are some really bad days with my GPS. There have been times when I've been going somewhere and I can see it over here on the right. And she says, whoever she is, I don't even know her name. She lives in this box on the dash of my car. She says, "Turn left." I mean, that's just crazy. I can see it over here on the right. And then when I go in the direction that I think is best, she says, "Make a legal U-turn." And when I ignore that, then she tells me that she is recalculating my route, as if she has a right to recalculate my route, this woman whom I don't even know, whose name I have never heard. And sometimes I just shut her down. And I just reach over and hit that button and shut her off and figure that I can do better by myself. And that's what Saul did. He had this God-planning system where God had told him specifically what he was supposed to do. And he reached over and pushed the button and said, "I can figure this out better by myself." And so, he who was so clearly instructed by God started making terrible decisions, one after the other. One day, he made a really rash vow. It sounded sort of super spiritual at the time. At the beginning of the day, he said, "All right, we're going to give this day of battle to God. And everyone in the Israelite army is to fast all day long. And anyone who doesn't fast will be killed." The trouble is, the message didn't get out to everybody in the army, including his own son. And his son that day grabbed a handful of honey and put it in his mouth. And when Saul found out, he ordered the execution of his son for eating some honey on a day that he had declared a day of fast. And if it had not been for the intervention of Saul's own soldiers that day, he would have killed Jonathan. You can Read for yourself the decline of Saul. It's all throughout the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel. As you read through those chapters, you come across a very famous story in 1 Samuel 15. It's about holy war. Oh, I know that what we in America typically think is that holy war is something about another religion in the Middle East and is a 21st century aberration. But actually, it's in the Bible, and it is in our holy scriptures. A holy war is when God calls for the annihilation of some people. And in this story, it's about the Amalekites. They were those terrorists that were continually attacking Israelite villages until God ordered that they be totally annihilated. And so here is the line from God in 1 Samuel 15:3 to Saul. Now go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. That is a troubling command for those of us who are 21st century Christians. And frankly, I'm unsure how to deal with this. It is troubling indeed. I know that our own country and other countries do precisely what those lines say. We, in modern warfare, drop bombs from planes onto cities where we kill everybody. We kill civilians and soldiers alike. We kill men and women. We kill the very old. We kill the very young. Newborns, we destroy. Pets and livestock, we just kill everybody. So we do the same thing. I also know that perhaps God was testing King Saul, and that God could have called it off at the last minute. Maybe that was his intent, although there's no indication of that, and that's not what it says. I also know that this story is really not about the Amalekites. It's really about Saul, because we know that he didn't have any trouble killing anybody. He was prepared to kill his own son for a trivial mistake. However, that day, he who was willing to kill anybody decided to let King Agag of the Amalekites live. He decided that selected individuals, it was okay for them to go on, and that he would kill off the weakest and worst of the livestock, but keep the rest for himself. And so it was a deliberate choice of disobedience to a command from God. You see, King Saul was supposed to be God's agent. God was supposed to be in charge, and he would do whatever God said. But bluntly, this king had decided that he would disobey God and do it his own way. Last year, I was at a small conference on the West Coast, and one of those that was there was the former Secretary of State, George Shultz. He was the Secretary of State during the Cold War with President Ronald Reagan. And someone in the conversation of the day asked him the question, "Secretary Shultz, how would you describe what was your foreign policy?" And he answered and said, "I never had any foreign policy. All I had was the foreign policy of President Reagan, and it was my job to implement it." That's an attitude that Saul didn't have. He was not to have his own military policy. He was simply to implement the military policy of God. When the prophet Samuel showed up and confronted him, Saul lied about it. And he blamed it on his soldiers, and he said that he was just keeping the best of the livestock so he could offer them as sacrifices to God. But Samuel replied, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king." So Saul was no longer fit to be king, and God was going to take his throne away from him.
He would not have his sons and his grandsons and his great-grandsons for 1,000 years sitting on the throne of Saul. He was done. He would be the last. Does that mean that he was forever alienated from God? Did this ancient king lose his salvation along with his crown? Well, apparently not. Saul's words to Samuel, "I have sinned. But please honor me before the elders of my people and before Israel. Come back with me so that I may worship the Lord your God." So Samuel went back with Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. He lost his crown. He didn't lose his relationship with God. His reign lasted, surprisingly, for many more years. But the epitaph of Saul is written in the last words of 1 Samuel 15. "And the Lord was grieved that he made Saul king over Israel." This person with so much promise and so much blessing, so much privilege, who failed so terribly that God grieved that he had made him king. Do you remember the embarrassing moment on January 20th, 2009, during the inauguration ceremony of Barack Obama as the 44th President of the United States? Supreme Court Justice John Roberts, there with a Bible that belonged to Abraham Lincoln, told the President-elect the words from the Constitution that he had to speak, and got them wrong. The Supreme Court Justice was supposed to say that "I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States." But he used the same words, he just got them out of order, and said that "I will execute the office of President of the United States faithfully." And so the White House counsel was concerned that it wasn't exactly right according to the Constitution. And therefore, on the next day, January 21st, 2009, there was another swearing-in ceremony in the map room of the White House when Barack Obama precisely spoke the words of the United States Constitution. Now, would he have not been the president? I don't know. Lawyers can wrangle over that. The point here was that in this country, you're supposed to get it exactly right as far as what the Constitution has to say. They wanted him to get it right. And that's what God wanted Saul to do. That's what God wants us to do, to get it right. Not that God will disown us if we don't. He is still a God of mercy and grace. But let us resolve as followers of Jesus Christ that we delight not to grieve God, but to get it right. Father, help us as sinners. Forgive us for all of our transgressions and wickedness. And by your Holy Spirit, challenge us to get it right for Jesus' sake.